And welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the U.S. Supreme Court faces a legitimacy crisis, and the United States faces a democracy deficit because of the power of the court. How should the U.S. address both of these concerns? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Following the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett during the 2020 presidential election, the U.S. Supreme Court majority held a conservative worldview that was not reflective of the popular vote for U.S. president. It continued the journey of the court in deciding cases that were unpopular among the majority of Americans. This past summer, several Supreme Court justices gave speeches and interviews proclaiming that the court was not political and was deserving of its historical standing as the protector of the U.S. Constitution. It recalls the famous Shakespearean quote from Macbeth, paraphrased for this issue, "Methinks the justices doth protest too much." On today's show, we will explore the legitimacy crisis the court faces and the historical context of this question of legitimacy. Today's panel is Christopher Schmidt, professor of law and co-director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States at the Chicago Kent School of Law. He's the author of The Sit-ins, Protest and Legal Change in the Civil Rights Era and Civil Rights in America, A History. Richard Pacelli, professor and department head in political science at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He's the co-author of Decision Making by the Modern Supreme Court and the author of The Supreme Court in a Separation of Powers System, The Nation's Balance Wheel. And Eric Siegel, Ash Family Chair, Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Originalism as Faith and Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. Thank you all for joining us. Eric Siegel, I'm going to ask you the first question because I know you've spoken about this question. The court is facing what's being described as a legitimacy crisis. Is this unique for the U.S. Supreme Court in U.S. history?
It definitely is not unique. Thank you for having me on. By the way, I'm very glad to be here with Rick and Chris. No, this is not unique. And there are various moments in American history we could turn to see the same kind of crisis, although of course it was done in different ways, different media outlets and that kind of thing. In 1857, the infamous Dred Scott case, the Supreme Court basically said that Congress could not end slavery in the territories and that African-Americans were never and could never be citizens. That case precipitated a crisis that was already unfolding, but the court certainly played its role. Throughout the late 19th century, the court turned the 14th Amendment and all the Reconstruction Amendments from a set of rules designed to help the newly freed slaves to a set of amendments that were helping railroads and big business. And I think a lot of people in 1890, 1995, and 1903 would have said to you, the court is really causing a crisis. From 1900 to 1936, the court struck down over 200 laws relating to unions and minimum wages and overtime laws, prompting the court packing crisis, which most of your listeners probably know about, when FDR basically said the court is full of old men and we need to save the Constitution from the court. Roe versus Wade, not in 1973, but just, you know, maybe 10 years later, basically ignited the Federalist Society, ignited the unification of evangelicals with the Republican Party. That created its own crisis. Bush versus Gore didn't create a crisis, but it didn't help the court's prestige, I don't think. And then, of course, we are where we are today. I just want to say that the reason we have been in this constant state of fighting and difficulty with the Supreme Court is that, and this is not a partisan statement, in my opinion, it's been a broken institution from the start. And the way to see that in a very quick soundbite is here's a rule that I think most democracies follow and all democracies follow, and we should follow it, but we don't. Never, ever give largely unreviewable power to government officials for life. It's just a terrible idea. And that's what our Supreme Court is. It's a government institution with a whole lot of power, and they hold their positions for life, and they're going to come to see the law and their personal values as the same. And that's what happens. And that's what's precipitated these crises over the years.
And Chris Schmidt, the court has had these issues certainly in the past. Is the current crisis, the current legitimacy crisis that the court faces, more intense? Or is it just sort of this, you know, the way Eric described it, sort of like a broken institution that has always, you know, had these challenges?
Well, I think Eric gave a really nice overview of the major points in our history where you see the court becoming a focal point for political debate. And it really is interesting to think about what is new about this and what is actually things that we've seen before, maybe in different forms, but basically the same sort of drama getting played over again. And the one thing that does strike me that seems somewhat different about what's going on today is the intensity of the focus on the court itself. The court has become a focal point for debate, but the idea that both political parties now see it as their to their political advantage to have court reform or some position on the court, some position on judicial decisions as a key part of what they're doing as a party, as a critical part of presidential elections. I do think that maybe it's not categorically new, but definitely in terms of the intensity we see here. And let me just give you a really interesting historical point, which I've been wrestling with in some of my own scholarship recently. Presidential candidates didn't really talk about the Supreme Court very much on a campaign trail until relatively recently. Even after some of these decisions that Eric went through that were incredibly contentious, Brown versus Board of Education, even if you go back to the 1930s during the court back in the debate of 1937, FDR didn't talk about the Supreme Court on a campaign trail in 1936. He didn't think it was an appropriate topic for political campaigning. That's changed, right? So the sort of the intensity and the bluntness of the engagement with the court as an institution, that does strike me as something we've seen some pretty dramatic changes over the last 10, 20, 30 years.
Richard Pacelli, I know that you've written about how the court, you know, serves this role in the balance of powers and, you know, it's historically played a pretty key role. I guess sort of a, you know, two questions in one, is this a role that it should be playing? And if it's not, what would be the implications for the democracy?
So I think that depending on, you know, where you stand is where you sit. And so depending on what you, you know, if you're a conservative, you want the court to do as much as it possibly can. And if you're a liberal, you're suddenly in favor of judicial restraint now. I think what's added a lot to this in the last couple of years is not just that, you know, so as both of the scholars here have noted, this has happened before. But I think that we've seen a couple of things that are a little bit different. One is the sort of hyper-partisanship, and we get it from time to time, but it seems to be particularly strong. And Chris mentioned sort of like attacks on the court, and those have sort of lessened in some ways, because if you're one of the out party, you don't want to attack the court and weaken it, and then you come back into power, and then the court is, you know, sort of weaker when you come on. But the other part is the way, and I don't want to sound partisan here, but how the last couple of Supreme Court nominations where Antonin Scalia dies and the Democrats sit in office but can't get a nomination through, and then they rush one through just when Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies. And so I think in the past, you know, I've always thought to not know the Supreme Court is to love the Supreme Court. And so the public didn't know much about the Supreme Court. And so it was relatively, it sort of gets away with a lot. But in Dred Scott and in the court packing plan of the 30s, the public knew, but soon the court rebounded. We're not seeing the court rebound to its past sort of success. And I think one thing, and I wish I could remember who I heard say this, but the idea that when an octogenarian dies, gets to determine what your rights are going to be, has really been sort of an interesting thing to think about. Antonin Scalia dies, if the Democrats get to replace him, that's going to tilt the court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies, the Republicans are able to put another person on the court, sort of moves it in that direction. And you've seen just incredibly bad luck from the Democrats, where they've held the office for a number of years, but you have Jimmy Carter, who doesn't get to make any nominations. You get Reagan and Nixon and Trump getting to make multiple nominations. So there are some changes that's occurred, but this has been sort of a long-term thing. To finish up just quickly, the court has lots of cases that involve sort of regulations, taxes, things like that. It can decide those unanimously, and those cases tend to be mixed, some liberal, some conservative. They buy the court a little leeway to then making decisions that are more controversial. And so So those are maybe slight legitimacy builders, and then they spend that legitimacy on decisions, you know, like reviewing Roe versus Wade or something like that.
If I might, just one observation. So we always tend to think our times are the worst or the best or whatever. In 1870, the Supreme Court said that Congress couldn't make paper money legal tender. It was the most important Supreme Court decision to date, even more important than Dred Scott, according to people living at the time. And it was a very partisan decision. The Democrats did not want the paper money to be legal tender. The Republicans did. Grant got two appointments the day that decision came down. A year later, the court reversed itself. Same facts, same everything, for no reason other than the people on the court changed. And if you read the newspapers in 1871, they accused Grant of packing the court with his cronies to make this change. I want to make that point because if you were living in 1870 or 1871, this was a huge deal for both creditors and debtors. And the court was right in the middle of it. And it was as serious and, you know, as anything that happens today. So this really has been going on for a long time. The internet makes everything bigger and more in our face. The other observation I want to make really fast is my close friend and retired judge, Richard Posner, has a line that I think applies to the Supreme Court in a very serious way. And it goes to what Rick said. If changing judges changes law, do we know what law is? And it is a fact that changing Supreme Court justices changes law dramatically, sometimes quickly. And I think, I don't know the answer to his question, by the way, but it's a great question.
Yes, Richard, you want to respond?
Didn't he also say, what am I, a potted plant? So, so he thought judges could make some decisions that were sort of in line with the times or with their views. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, he didn't believe in doctrine at all. I mean, he believed in facts, consequences, and results. But his point is really valid, though. And I really think, you know, interested non-lawyers should think about this more than they probably do. And when I say this to doctors and scientists and, you know, accountants, they really take a step back. If Clarence Thomas doesn't get on the court because Thurgood Marshall stays 6 more months, that's all it takes is Thurgood Marshall to hang on 6 more months. No Shelby County, no Citizens United, no Heller, no Bush versus Gore. And we live in a different world, not just a different country, but a different world.
Hmm. And Chris, you wanted to jump in?
I just want to pick up on a point that Eric made. Again, I think it's a really good point. The idea that these debates, these really political debates, people treating the court in a political way, the court being recognized as a political actor, nothing new. Now, the one thing I think is really interesting and potentially different, and again, this is still playing out before our eyes, is that in the past, we had these cataclysmic debates about the court. Certainly Dred Scott is exhibit A for that, but you have a number of other ones. And what the court was able to do in the aftermath of these moments is recede from the stage, right? And this gets to Rick's point about the idea that to not know the court is to love the court. It went back in the background. It built up whatever political legal capital it had, whatever legitimacy building foundations it had. And it could do that because people were willing to ignore the court in the aftermath of these moments and go on to other things. And again, you just look at the confirmation hearings. There have been contentious confirmation hearings tracing all the way back to the beginning of the Republic. We have decades in which there are just not really contentious confirmation hearings, even in the aftermath of quite contentious court rulings. Right. So people were willing, political actors were willing to sort of put it aside and focus on other things. And I don't see that happening over the last couple of decades. Every confirmation hearing is as major a political event as the previous one, even more so. And now we have, even when the court's not issuing opinions, we have court reform commissions. We have debates about the court. So it seems like at the moment, it is constantly in presence of the sort of in the limelight. And it seemed also to have gotten to the position where however it rules on certain cases, it's not going to get out of the headlines, right? It's there to stay for the foreseeable future, regardless of what it does.
There is a way around that, though. This is Siegel again. There is a way around that. I mean, it won't happen. This is utopia. The court could go back to Alexander Hamilton, not the actor, but the real guy. Hamilton was warned by a guy named Brutus before the Constitution was ratified, that it's a really bad idea to have this, these judges have, you know, judicial review and final say and all this power and everything. And Hamilton said in Federalist number 78, don't worry about it. They'll only overturn laws when there's an irreconcilable variance between a statute and the Constitution, meaning a clear error, crystal clear inconsistency. That's how Hamilton viewed this. I'm not saying we have any realistic chance of going back to that, but judges do understand burdens of proof. So just one quick example, Court of Appeals judges do not reverse district courts on factual findings very often because their review is clearly erroneous. Was the factual finding clearly erroneous? And although there are some bad actors, most Court of Appeals judges take that deference seriously. And they understand it because lawyers understand deference. They don't understand abortion, guns, and healthcare, but they understand deference. So, you know, I'd like to think that a different set of people might have more humility and modesty and take the court out of the headlines by returning issues to be bipartisan about this, like abortion, guns, and affirmative action, all of them, to the states. And if the court did that, they would get out of the headlines very quickly. That'd be my fantasy.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the Supreme Court's legitimacy crisis with Christopher Schmidt of the University of Chicago Kent School of Law, Richard Pacelli of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and Eric Siegel of Georgia State University College of Law. Now, Chris Schmidt, one thing that sort of comes to mind here is that, I mean, this idea the court has been litigating on so many of the core issues that the U.S. faces. And you had highlighted the fact that not only has it become partisan, but it's become so much of a political issue. I know that in the 80s, this was a significant issue that Ronald Reagan had raised, that in my own lifetime, that's when I most remember when the court became the significant, you know, partisan issue. Is this kind of a nexus where the most important issues seem to be decided by the courts? And so the parties are saying he who controls the courts controls these core issues as opposed to legislatures?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things going on. And one is the court has, over its history and accelerating over the last 50, 70 years, has taken on issues that it previously hadn't engaged with. And it's also been taking on issues that are of high social salience to the people. So people are just seeing what the court's doing in a way that feels more consequential. And I'll just say, it's not clear that it obviously is more consequential. In the early 20th century, the Supreme Court was striking down economic regulation that had effects on people's lives that are every bit as deep as these social issues. But again, the social issues, I think, are just more sort of close to the people, what they're thinking about, when they're engaging with. This combined with the fact that the court has been politicized in large part because the political parties have become ideologically sorted in a way that is much clearer which side you're on, right? So say, just to give an example, Brown versus Board of Education, say you supported school desegregation in 1954 when Brown was issued. That was a bipartisan issue. Right. I mean, the strongest opponents to that were Southern Democrats, but Northern Democrats were actually supportive of the decision, as were Republicans, who were mostly in the North. Right. So you didn't have the partisan divisions around all these issues that the court engaged with. Now you do, pretty much across the board. It's pretty rare for the court to engage in a major issue in which it's not easy to look at the political parties and see how they come down differently on these issues. So that strikes me as different. The court is taking on more, but I think it's really how these issues play out in the politics of today.
Richard, I'd love to get your thoughts on this as well. I mean, even the whole process of confirming Supreme Court justices seems to have changed. And of course, the nomination that always gets highlighted is, you know, that moment that this changes is Robert Bork. Is there a way to reform that process that might help to build legitimacy, or at least encourage, you know, some degree of bipartisanship, you know, less controversial nominees, you know, to the court?
That would certainly be one thing. I think you see a lot of times that presidents float trial balloons and get an idea of what kinds of opposition there might be. Now, in recent times, I mean, you saw Bill Clinton pick people that were, you know, Stephen Breyer, people like that, that were, you know, at least some Republicans could nominate. But oftentimes what you'd hear today is if a president, you know, put up a nominee who was more moderate, you'd hear all sorts of wrangling from that president's own party. Why are you doing this? Why are you wasting the nomination? You know, if you look back to, back from, you know, Kent Law School, if you think about John Paul Stevens as turning out to be much more moderate, Souter was seen as a mistake by by Bush. And so the younger Bush said he wouldn't make those same kinds of mistakes. So I think you have a situation where, yes, if I put a moderate on the court, I might get some support from the other party, but I might lose some support inside my party as well.
Although Eric Segal, that seemed to be Barack Obama's strategy in nominating Merrick Garland. I mean, his own party, I guess, never really got the chance to criticize it because that nomination never even came forward. So was the lesson learned there that somebody who's moderate or not moderate doesn't really matter? It's really just party identification?
Well, I agree with both Chris and Rick. This is a change that we haven't in history had all conservative Republicans, all liberal Democrats, where the most liberal Republican is more conservative than the most conservative Democrat, which is where we are. We have been since 2006, I think, or earlier. Just whatever I think, I will tell you that Justice O'Connor said at my law school twice, actually, that the moment confirmation hearings changed was not Judge Bork. He was not going to get that seat at that moment in time, television or not, because the Democrats controlled the Senate, and that was a pivotal median seat. It changed with television. That's what Justice O'Connor says. And I tend to think she's probably mostly right about that. People didn't even show up for the confirmation hearings until the 40s, I think. I think Frankfurter was maybe the first, and that was the whole anti-Semitic Jewish thing going on. So it's what's television's been a big problem here. But I think I've written about the confirmation hearings and criticized them, and especially Lanny Kagan, who I think had a moment in time as the former dean of Harvard Law School and somebody who wrote in the Chicago Law Review that the confirmation hearings were a charade. She called them a vapid charade, which she walked back in the first 1 minute of her confirmation hearing. But she had a moment in time where she could have changed this. But I think criticizing the confirmation hearings is not, it flows from a misunderstanding about the court, I think, in that Americans, no matter what, when they're polled, they give two answers to the how the Supreme Court acts. They all pretty much say that, yes, it is political. But then they also say, well, yeah, but law plays a big part of it, you know? And there's kind of a schizophrenia about that. The reality is, in my study of constitutional law, is that there's very little law there, and the justices will do whatever they can get away with. Now, that's a big constraint. What they can get away with is a big constraint. But that's the only one, and it's not a legal constraint. Until we fix that problem, until we stop the court from telling Congress they can't end slavery in the territories, or for that matter, end segregation before it began, which Congress tried in the 1870s and the court said no, or until we get the court to butt out of guns, abortion, affirmative action, and all that stuff, then the confirmation hearings are just going to, the charade's going to continue, because they're never going to admit that. The court, that's how the court protects its own prestige. We're doing law. And that's both Thomas and Sotomayor. You know, that's everybody. They all say that, but they're not doing law. And until the American people really absorb that, I think our confirmation hearings are going to be bad.
Yes, Richard, you want to respond?
Yeah, just two quick things. Number one is, it's not so important who's going on the Supreme Court, it's who's leaving. And so if you're replacing a Republican with a Republican, you get that person through relatively easily. It's when you're replacing one party for the other. And the second thing is, right now there's an incentive, particularly in Congress, but also to some degree with the president, to let the court do as much of this stuff as possible, take themselves out from having to, and then they can rail against the court and they can run against the court, but they don't have to make those tough decisions. And so that, to me, is the ticket to stopping the activism of the court, is having the other branches of government step up and do their jobs.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, so I think that's a really good point, but it is worth noting that if the court were to step back, if the court were to recede from the spotlight and become a less important institution, not only are there political actors, presidents in Congress, who like to dump off things on the court and prefer not to take care of it, it is also worth noting that the American people generally have a very robust view of the court, and they have a vision in which they often look back at the court and see all those decisions that they like, many of which are the court actually getting quite engaged, overruling popular or legislative decisions, and they tend to push aside the ones they don't like. So I think both sides really like the idea of a strong court. And it's worth thinking about, if a court were to step back, it's not like they could just start anew, right? There would be huge legitimacy costs to the step back. And maybe at some point, 20, 30, 50 years down the road, the court would then have cleared its docket from the major contentious decisions and have achieved that sort of the aspiration that Eric spelled out. But again, like one of the steps there would be what, to pull back on the issue of abortion, right? There is nothing that is more threatening at the moment to the court, at least if you're just looking at legitimacy as in opinion polls, than what it does on this abortion issue. And there doesn't seem to be a really sort of a solution that is going to make the court, strengthen the court here. If it upholds precedent, there's going to be a lot of people who are extremely upset with that, especially because the expectations have been turned up over the last few weeks. And if they turn over Roe versus Wade, of course, that's going to be a major contentious issue that's going to resonate for years and years down the road.
Eric Siegel?
So, again, this is utopian. I agree with almost everything Chris said, but not everything. This term, the court is hearing a big gun case. It is hearing the abortion case, and it could take the affirmative action case out of Harvard, although technically that's a statutory case, but they could use that. And again, in a utopian world where we don't live in, I think the American people would be extremely happy if the court announced in all three cases, you know what? We've been doing too much for too long. Elections shouldn't turn on our votes. Where the Constitution is clear, we will enforce it. But where the Constitution is unclear, then the people get to decide. And if they did that on several of these highly contentious, visible issues, so if we did that for both, even this term, just guns and abortion, I think they would be lauded by everybody. I do. Of course, I'm pro-choice all the way down. I couldn't be more pro-choice. But I think Roe and Casey are very controversial. I think there are gun control experts who don't think Heller was correctly decided. And I think if the court could extricate itself from this in a way where, you know, we're going to budge in where the Constitution's clear, where it's not, we won't. That could work with the American people. I am confident that could work with the American people. Who it wouldn't work with are politicians and the Supreme Court itself. But I do think that's a solution.
And Richard Pacelli, you wanted to respond?
Yes, and I think that's what John Roberts has been trying to do for the last few years. He's kind of sat in the middle as the court's been to balance and to say, let's leave things like Obamacare to the legislature. Let's not overturn those sorts of things. But now even he's outnumbered.
Sorry, I just can't. I just read a big piece on Roberts and I can't let that go.
You go, no, Eric.
That's just a false narrative. I'm sorry, it's just false. Yes, he let Obamacare go. Yes, he voted one time on abortion. His judicial aggression in the First Amendment is effectively what the court was doing from 1900 to 1936. Shelby County is one of the worst reasoned decisions in American history. And it had dramatic effects on voting rights and everything else. I agree, Roberts thinks out his judicial conquering in a more detailed way than others, and he plays a longer game, but he is nowhere in the middle. He is a deeply conservative man who has written deeply conservative opinions. Campaign finance reform, he's the king. I mean, he's written like five of them. And so I just have to say, is he 100% like that? No, but he is not. He is deeply conservative, and he's issued deeply conservative opinions about his career.
When we come back, proposals for reforming the court have advocated change. Would these help to rebuild the court's image and legitimacy? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How should the court in the United States be changed? Already, several proposals have been put forward. How much would these help to shift the court's image and its legitimacy? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the legitimacy crisis on the court, the court's proper role in the American democratic system, and some of the political challenges the court faces. Our panel today is Christopher Schmidt, who is at the Chicago Kent School of Law, Richard Pacelli at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and Eric Siegel at Georgia State University College of Law. Chris Schmidt, I'll start with you. One of the proposals on reform of the court is that maybe nine's not the right number, and there should be an increased number of members of the court. Is this just a partisan court packing proposal, or is there some legitimacy, you know, to the argument that perhaps there should just be a larger number of members of the court?
I think the first response has to be that the only people at the moment who are supporting adding justices to the court are people who are progressives and liberals who don't like the direction the court has gone in. So clearly it is one that at the moment has a clear ideological valence. I mean, it's worth noting that historically changing the number of justices on the court hasn't necessarily been ideological. It often has been political, as in certain political actors do see advantage in changing the number, but sometimes it's just from trying to adjust the number to accord with the needs of getting the work of the court done. But the number has been nine. It's been nine for a very long time. It's been at nine, it was set at nine and soon after the Civil War, and it hasn't changed since. And there has been one prominent stress test prior to the debate over court packing today, and that's back in the 1930s, where Franklin Roosevelt proposed legislation that almost passed into Congress, which is dominated by the Democratic Party that Roosevelt controlled, to add justices to the court. And this is clearly a political maneuver because Roosevelt didn't like the court striking down his New Deal legislation. So he had a proposal to add justices to the court. He justified it as the court was needed help. They were getting old. They needed some help with their work. That was just a cover. Clearly, he just wanted to change the direction of the court, change their decisions. And that was defeated. And for generations after that, people assumed that court packing was something we didn't really talk about. It was something that was put out there and rejected. And most people across the ideological spectrum said it was rightly rejected. In recent years, it's come back. And I think the fact that it's come back and come back relatively strong on the political left is an indication about how heated and contentious the debate about the court has become in recent years.
But Eric Siegel, my understanding of what happened with this court packing was it was defeated, and the history books certainly record this as Roosevelt with a bit of a power grab, but that the court saw that it was out of step politically with the American electorate. There were actually some doctrinal changes, or at least some decisions the court made. They weren't quite as intransigent and anti-New Deal that they had been. So would even the threat of increasing the size of the court kind of get their attention and say, at least at a minimum, maybe you should reconsider some of these decisions because it's generating so much political opposition?
Well, just a couple of things. The proposal actually, I think, never got out of committee. It was never voted on by the whole Congress. The committee voted it down. And one justice, ironically, a Justice Roberts, different Justice Roberts, he did change his mind at a time when the court was 4-4. He was mostly part of the anti-New Deal wing, and then he flipped sides. We don't know. There's a whole historical controversy about whether he did that and when, what he knew about it, and I don't want to get into any of that. I do want to say to Chris that there is at least one person who's been in favor of changing the number of the court for non-ideological reasons. When Justice Scalia died, and we had four Republicans, and this, but I'm telling this story now, not because it's about me, but because it is reflective of our country. When Justice Scalia died, we had four conservatives and four Democrats, and Justice Kennedy, the most liberal Republican, was more conservative than the most liberal Democrat prior. And I went around the country and wrote in the New York Times and wrote a large article, we should freeze the court right here. An even number of justices from both parties. The Senate can do this through, the president can send over whoever he wants. But as we now know and learn, the Senate doesn't have to give them a hearing. And basically, if a Republican dies, you replace him with a Republican, Democrat, vice versa. I had a whole statutory proposal for independence. I'm a progressive and I'm a liberal and all that. This number needed to be changed, I thought, when the Democrats thought they were going to win before Trump got elected, and my good friends in the academy had their mouth watering about all the great things that a new liberal court was going to do. And I was saying, no, that would be terrible because the political pushback to that would just hurt us even more. The point I want to make here is there are nonpartisan reasons to think about the court in a different way. And I would like to see an evenly balanced court among Democrats and Republicans so that in every case, a Republican would have to join with Democrats or vice versa. Again, well-informed non-law professors. In fact, most political scientists I talked to about this proposal in 2016, they liked the idea. I think there are ways to go about court reform that would not be so partisan. I agree with Chris today, though, with the Republicans in charge of everything, it is by definition a partisan thing to do, because the Republicans would have to basically unilaterally disarm, which is what I recommended Democrats do in 2016. And I was laughed out of every room I was in, and kind of think I told you so is appropriate for me at this point.
And Richard Pasquale, what are some of your thoughts about whether it be increasing the size of the court, or are there any sort of institutional alterations within the court that might help to build its legitimacy?
I think short of, you know, having an even number of justices, which would, you know, which if you could arrange it that it was, you know, actually even might make a difference. But adding more justices, I think just, you know, it's the same problem in one way or the other. You know, you take a foot off of one end and sew it onto the other, it's still the same, you know, sort of blanket. To me, in terms of thinking about it, the probable likely thing that would that could do something might be some sort of term limits, you know, 15 to 20 year term limits for justices. That might be the opportunity. Now, in terms of doing that, you could allow it so that justices sort of came off so that presidents would have the opportunity to not pack the court with a lot of people. But the, you know, what would happen if somebody died in the middle of a term or resigned in the middle of a term? I mean, today, justices stay for life, but it wasn't that long ago where justices, you know, might leave at a relatively early age, go back to a private practice, go back to something else. And so,
Eric Siegel, that seems to address one of your concerns, which is the fundamentally undemocratic nature of these key decisions that the electorate faces being made by people who are appointed for life without any sort of a review.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in favor of term limits, believe me, but that has to be done very, very carefully. So any term limits proposal, I think, has to come with, and this is complicated, this is your last job. You can serve on the lower courts, but you can't go to big New York law firms after you're a Supreme Court justice. I still think there would be a long line for that job, but I do think that's, you know, I'm in favor of term limits, so we have to deal with that problem. There is the counter argument that with term limits, they would just do a lot more faster. So I think term limits and the number of justices on the court and all kinds of other issues do duck the main issue, which is we have an incredibly imprecise constitution with contested and mostly irrelevant history to our time anyway, and unreviewable and decisions that are effectively unreviewable by people we don't vote for. And well, we have to take away that power somehow, but we have to get right to the power, not to the structure, but to the power.
And Chris Schmidt, one thing that I'm always noticing is, in particular the last few electoral cycles, presidents, in particular Democratic nominees, have said that they need to name somebody to the court who is not a judge, somebody with a real political background on the court. I mean, even to the point where I've read the proposal that if, for instance, Justice Breyer does step down, as some have speculated, that perhaps even Kamala Harris might be Joe Biden's nominee. Would that change the court if we put pretty explicitly political actors as opposed to judges who we frequently have never heard of, at least those of us who don't follow these questions haven't heard of until they get nominated?
Yeah, I'm going to start off by saying that's not going to happen. I've heard the names that have been floated, particularly right by Democratic presidents over the last three decades. Some fascinating people have been thrown around. And my understanding is they've never really gotten all that seriously considered, and with decreasing frequency in recent years. Having said that, yes, it would change the court. And I think it would change the court in some positive directions. And all you need to do is to look at American history. And some of the most influential justices have been people who weren't judges, or at least didn't have substantial judicial careers. I mean, John Marshall, the great Chief Justice of the early Republic, clearly fits that. Chief Justice Earl Warren, right? He was governor of California, and he got on the court. Hugo Black, incredibly influential justice, was a senator before he got on the court. And there's definitely, you know, challenges for these people because they get on the court and they have a pretty steep learning curve, but they do bring new insights, right? They bring in different sensibilities, different lifetime experiences. And I think one pretty clear lesson of history is the diversity of experiences on the court is beneficial to the decision-making of the court. The court has certainly not always gotten the issues right, but some of its, I think, most celebrated decisions are, at least in part, a product
of people coming to the court with these different experiences.
Eric Siegel, you've written a book that says the Supreme Court is not a court and the justices are not judges. So what are your thoughts about, you know, well, somebody with a political corner?
I agree with Chris 100%. And this whole idea that we now have this Supreme Court justice kind of template where you go to an Ivy League law school, all but Justice Barrett went to Harvard or Yale, basically. Then you clerk for a Supreme Court justice, first a court of appeals judge. Then you maybe spend some time in academia or maybe the government, and then you go work for the Supreme Court. It's a horrific, horrific idea because they're not doing law. And foreign countries have recognized this. This is why Germany and other countries have specialized constitutional courts, because they recognize that deciding whether Georgia can prohibit all abortions or Chicago can prohibit all handguns or Arizona can fund campaigns the way they want to are not breach of contract, tort, negligence, property type issues. They are political issues at their core. They're who define us as a country. So just going back to Chris's point real fast, having politicians on the court, successful politicians like Earl Warren and others, John Marshall, they understand that. They get that. And that's why Warren was able to get a unanimous decision in Brown. It wasn't because he was a great lawyer. It's because he was a great politician. By the way, the Constitution does not require one to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court. Now, I'm not, you know, there's a lot of stuff the Supreme Court does that may require some lawyering skills, but constitutional law is not one of them. And, you know, Scalia was a huge hypocrite. Huge. But what he said in Casey, in dissent, Casey is the big abortion case that reaffirmed Roe versus Wade. In his dissent in that case, he said value judgments should be voted on, not mandated from up high. Now, he didn't follow that. He struck down over 140 laws in his career, most of which had no basis in being struck down. But his insight was correct. In a democracy, value judgments should be voted on, not mandated by Justice Ginsburg, Justice Kagan, Justice Roberts, or Justice Scalia.
And Richard Pacelli, we tend to think of the court ruling on these big issues, the issues about, you know, gun control and abortion and, you know, same-sex marriage, you know, et cetera. But the court actually does play a pretty substantial role politically, you know, in a lot of areas that don't necessarily grab the headlines, but suggest that they should have a bit more of a political background. I know the court has certainly engaged in some policy decisions. And even, for instance, Justice Barrett's speculations about the nature of adoption versus abortion, et cetera, really had very little to do with anything legal. It was really kind of a policy and a social issue. So doesn't this really kind of call for a court that is much better versed in those questions?
Well, certainly, I think you could, you know, argue that, you know, we train judges in lower courts. There are specialized courts where judges have to have a specific background. So, you know, but once you're up there, you know, as one justice used to say, we're not infallible because we're last, or you know, we're infallible because we're last. You know, we get to make the last move in the game. And if it's a constitutional question, the ability to overturn that decision is quite limited. So, but I think that gets back to a lot of Eric's comments about, you know, sort of the problems of the system. I'm not sure if politicians would solve those problems. I mean, we would like to think that judges, and perhaps empirically this doesn't happen, but we'd like to think that judges at least are somewhat more, at least a little to the law. What would be the moorings that would be out there for politicians besides, I guess, you know, they don't have to run. I mean, you know, Earl Warren came into office as an Eisenhower appointee, and along with Brennan, the two mistakes he claimed he made as president. And Warren was sort of the head of the internment camps. And there wasn't any guess that this guy was going to turn out to be a massive civil libertarian who presided over the constitutional revolution. So, and the Reagan administration, I think, was famous for, along with the Nixon administration, sort of checking people at the door, putting them on lower courts, seeing if they were going to be ideologically pure enough. And then when they got on the court, you knew what you were getting. You know, with a politician, who knows?
So. You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org.
We're discussing the Supreme Court's legitimacy crisis with Christopher Schmidt at the Chicago Kent School of Law, Richard Pacelli of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and Eric Siegel of Georgia State University College of Law. When I made that comment about Justice Barrett's speculation about the social issues on adoption, abortion, I saw a response from you, Eric Siegel. What are your thoughts about justices considering that as the foundation for a decision on something like, say, abortion rights?
Well, I think you're actually misreading my response. My response was incredibly negative, but not for that reason. The justices have no choice but to take into consideration all kinds of policy consequences, because the text, it doesn't help, and the history doesn't help, and no one's looking over their shoulder. So at the end of the day, that's what they do. My reaction to that was from a not a constitutional law perspective, from a human being perspective. No matter where you are on the spectrum from pro-choice to pro-life, and I very much respect people who say abortion's murder, and you know, I'm not denigrating that view. The idea that increases in adoption availability, which I'm not even sure is true empirically, but even if it was, somehow reduces a woman's need to terminate a pregnancy who wants to terminate that pregnancy, is quite literally insane. I mean, it does not take into account all, like 90% of the reasons why some women want to terminate their pregnancies. And the idea that men would tell women, you have to undergo these physical changes, maybe lose time at work, make this incredibly important decision you don't want to make, because at the end of the process, you can give your baby away. A man would never take that kind of treatment about a man's body. So I was just responding to how idiotic, I'm not going to mince words here, it was an idiotic, patronizing, condescending, stupid idea that should never have seen the light of day.
And Chris Schmidt, these issues about the way in which the court has been used to resolve so many of these key issues have actually been a number of scholars, and actually I remember Ruth Bader Ginsburg saying that one of her concerns about Roe v. Wade was, A, it was the way it was decided, that if you're going to decide that it should be about women's rights and women's bodily autonomy. But secondly, it should have been decided legislatively, that activists should have compelled legislative action to enshrine abortion rights, because quite frankly, people become complacent if they think the court is protecting their rights as opposed to fighting for those rights. That would fit Eric Siegel's argument for judicial restraint, which is, if you want a right, you fight for the right. Should that be the role the court plays then, is to back off and tell people, if you want these rights, go out and fight for them?
So let me introduce a middle ground, because again, I'm sympathetic to some of Eric's concerns. I just don't take them as far as he do. I think the Supreme Court has an incredibly important role to play in protecting rights, and sometimes the court does need to strike down the decisions of elected lawmakers in doing that. And going back to Justice Ginsburg's response to Roe versus Wade, she didn't necessarily say Roe versus Wade should not have been decided as it was. She said it did too much too quickly, and it was, could have been reasoned better. So then I think we can think about the idea of judicial dialogue, right? Courts have a dialogue with American society in which they're both participants. Now, I think Eric's concern, against one I'm sympathetic to, is oftentimes the court seems to be telling American society what to do and not really listening to much else, right? So the dialogue is not really functioning particularly well. But yeah, I still think there's value in that dialogue, right? So if you take Ginsburg's critique of Roe, perhaps it should have decided Roe more modestly, recognized perhaps a more limited right to abortion, which didn't strike down abortion laws across the country, but maybe tried to push the issue ahead. And then again, not sure how it would work out, but the idea was is we might have had a more productive debate about reproductive rights in the wake of that. And she also thinks it would have been more reproductive if we were talking about gender equality as opposed to some abstract liberty concept, which never really fitted all that well. So I do think it's worth thinking about the court and how the court can play an important role in advancing issues, bringing issues that may be in the background to the foreground. The court has an important role to play when there's consolidation in the country around particular ideas. The court can step in and push it kind of over the finishing line in a way. And I'll just say, I think the same-sex marriage decision, Obergefell from a few years back, it kind of fits that. The country was moving in a direction. The court stepped in. It was still contentious, but I think it did so in a way that moved us as a nation closer to resolution of that particular issue. So again, all things are not abortion. There are many other issues the court engages with, many times in which there's a productive back and forth between society and the court
I think that needs to be part of the sort of the menu of options when we think about what an ideal role for the court would be in our society.
Yes, Richard Pacelli, you want to respond?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I think, you know, we've often thought about the court in general and the specifics of sort of the confirmation hearings as the potential for being sort of what people have called a vital national seminar, where we can discuss these kinds of issues and put them out there to the voters or to, you know, at least to the public. But the court, like Congress, does its best to kind of obfuscate the way that it makes decisions, how those decisions are announced and things. And so they don't kind of take part in this in this process of kind of informing the public. And, you know, I'd say Congress and the court are probably equally guilty of those sorts of things, that they could advance these things. Now, I think earlier we talked a little bit about, you know, what if the court just sort of farmed this back out to the states and let them decide? I don't know how, you know, then we get into some different problems of, you know, if you lived in one part of the country, you'd have rights. And if you lived in another part of the country, you would not have rights. And particularly if you were, you know, not wealthy or well-heeled, that you could sort of move where you wanted to move for those, you know, those kinds of circumstances. So, you know, I think the court said, you know, when the court tries to make a decision, that decision sweeping gets itself in lots of trouble. That's where its legitimacy is most threatened, if it can't see that sort of through.
I think the same-sex marriage example is the exception to the rule. And I think it only happened because Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had the insight not to do anything at the state level. First, they struck down the federal law, and she joined a decision dismissing a California case on jurisdictional grounds. She didn't believe in those grounds at all. She just didn't want to do too much. Decision issue back to lower courts, who then followed the Supreme Court. That was well done by Justice Ginsburg. But that's the exception, not the rule. And I just want to say to Richard, we live in that country now where rights, and I always have, where rights differ depending where you are in the country. The law of abortion in New York in the federal courts is much different than the law of abortion in Texas in the federal courts. And same true for guns, and same is true for affirmative action and all types of other things. I do want to say, again, at the bottom line level here, if there are five justices who think results should be X and four on a big issue and four think it should be Y, even if it's 6-3, that suggests to me, no, we should let the states experiment with this and deal with it. And I just don't understand the thinking of 300 million people who are roughly divided on an issue and then say, oh, yeah, you lawyers, you decide in Washington, unless the goal is to stop us from going to war. That's a war with each other. That's a worthy goal. We're about, though, to enter an era where the Supreme Court can't even stop that. So I think the court getting out of it, I think the pendulum has to swing way to the other side. And then we can come back and the court can do more. But unless the court steps out of these things, I think we're in deep trouble.
And Chris, one thing that sort of keeps coming to mind here is we've mentioned same-sex marriage, a number of other cases. There's this narrative that the court has given us these rights, that the courts gave women the right to an abortion as opposed to it being, you know, a part of the women's rights movement and recognition from society. I think of the number of times, you know, history books and historical narratives suggest that desegregation was the result of Brown versus Board of Education, not as a result of lots of people who were dedicated to desegregation and actually going out and doing the desegregating. Is this one of the real challenges with the court? Obviously, there's a balance here with the court recognizing what's going on in society and trying to recognize it, maybe even pushing it a little bit. But this perception that our rights are given to us by the court, as opposed to the court responding to what's going on in society, you know, particularly in the political society.
Yeah, so I'll just get back to the idea of a dialogue. We have a dialogue in which the Supreme Court ruling is at the midpoint. Right. So we have social activism, social movements, political shifts. We have legal advocacy, all of which feed into court decisions. These major landmark decisions we're talking about would never have happened if not for all that prior work leading up to it, the majority of which happens far outside the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court issues this decision. But that's not the end of the story. Right. These decisions, how they're received in society, are going to have a lot to do about whether these rights are actually recognized or not. Right. So Brown versus Board of Education, again, is a powerful example of a decision which had a lot that fed into it. The court issued its decision. And then at least in the Deep South, nothing happened for about a decade. And then eventually things happened. But why did they happen? The court played some role, but the primary role for why things eventually moved and turned to desegregating schools across the South had a lot more to do with people fighting on the streets. That's the civil rights movement, political changes. That's the Johnson administration in particular. Other things were going on here that contributed to it. So the idea, and this is, again, we in our memory have a shorthand vision of the court sort of stepping in and doing these things, and that's the story. It's never the full story. The full story flows from before and after. And once we understand that, we understand the court in its context, which is a much more accurate understanding of what's going on here.
But Richard Pacelli, I'll give you the last word.
Yes, I definitely agree. But when the court makes that decision, that's the point at which that decision gets legitimated. And we've been sort of talking about legitimacy here a little bit without maybe defining it as fully as we should. But it gives the court sort of the authority to make these decisions. And so when it makes a decision like that, it stamps it with an imprimatur. Now, certainly wouldn't have happened without something to get them to the door, but they opened the door.
We've been discussing the court's legitimacy in the American system. Our panel today has been Christopher Schmidt. He is the professor of law and co-director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States at the Chicago Kent School of Law. He's the author of The Sit-ins, Protest and Legal Change in the Civil Rights Era and Civil Rights in America, A History. Richard Pacelli, a professor and department head in political science at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He's the co-author of Decision Making by the Modern Supreme Court and the author of The Supreme Court in a Separation of Powers System, The Nation's Balance Wheel. And Eric Siegel, Ash Family Chair, Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Originalism as Faith and Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. Thank you all very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.